Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey everybody, this is Raymond. I just wanted to drop a little disclaimer up front to let you know that we had some technical difficulties with this episode. We pulled it together pretty quickly and we're very lucky that Amanda could join us, but she didn't have her regular recording set up on such short notice, so her mic gets a little choppy at times. We still think it's a great conversation that's well worth the listen, especially during the spooky season, and we appreciate all your patience and support. That said, enjoy the show and have a happy Halloween.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Talking to Tan. I'm your co-host, Raymond Creamer, and with me as always, the great Michael Burns.
Oh, well, welcome to be back. This has been so much fun, and I'm glad everyone stuck with us throughout the series.
Yeah. And we're also joined today by a very special guest, returning champion from last week's Titanalyze This trivia episode, Amanda Shirker.
Honestly, so excited for the 20th episode of this delightful series.
Yeah. We've come such a long way, and longtime listeners know we've been talking to Tan every week for, like Amanda said, 20 weeks now, and I feel like our conversations about the movie have changed pretty substantially ever since it came out and we were all actually able to see it. So to catch up our listeners who may not have been able to make it to the theater quite yet, Michael's going to start us off with a little recap of the film. Michael, what do you got?
Absolutely. So for anyone who has not seen this film yet, and of course, we recommend that you get out, you find it, you see it if you can. Okay, so Titan, it's a movie about what happens when you fuck a car, but it's also about so much more. The movie starts with a young woman in France named Alexia. After throwing a little fit in the car, her dad gets in a car accident, her head gets cracked open like a cantaloupe, and we see her get a titanium plate put into her head. Fast forward, as an adult, she's an exotic dancer working at car shows, and she doesn't just work with the cars, she works on the cars, i.e. she has sex with a car within the first 10 minutes of the film. Along with having sex with the car in the first 10 minutes, she also does some murder. Now, two things happen. A, she does so much murder that the police get onto her trail. She has to go on the lam. Two, she had unprotected sex with the car. She didn't use a car condom, which is a real thing. Google it. I swear to God. So she is both on the lam and pregnant with a car baby. She then impersonates a missing boy who's been gone for 10 years, goes to the police, and ends up going to live with the missing boy's father. During this time, she ingrains herself in the world of a bunch of masculine French firefighters, all while trying to hide her identity, which means binding her breast and her pregnant stomach as her stomach continues to rip and oil leaks from her nipples. All along, we see that her new adopted father, Vincent, is struggling with growing old, shooting steroids into his buttocks most nights to try to keep his virile masculinity. It ends up becoming a story about these two people finding love in each other. We see a lot of blurred identity lines, and, you know, spoiler alert right here, if you haven't seen the movie, stop. But she gives birth to a car baby at the end. So that's the main recap. But I think an important thing about this movie is it's more of, and we can maybe talk about this later, more of like a vibe than it is a plot. I don't think what makes the movie good is necessarily the machinations of story, but sort of the explorations of character. But I'm jumping ahead, so let's start with this. I mean, Raymond, obviously you've talked for 20 weeks now about what you think about the movie, what you think it's going to be. We sent you to France. You went to Julia Ducournau's house and tried to talk to her. She was very rude to you, and I apologize for that once again.
Where she was coming from. I was rapping on her windows at all hours of the day.
It was aggressive. Very rude. Oh, and when he says rapping on her windows, he means he was physically rapping. He wrote a bunch of songs. And was just rapping outside of her window. but I'm very curious. We've all seen it now. What were your first impressions of this movie, Raymond?
My first impression of it was in the theater for its West Coast premiere at Beyond Fest. I saw her first movie at Beyond Fest, and it was the greatest theatrical experience of my life. And I was going in kind of chasing that dragon. I'm a huge fan of Raw, and this was easily my most anticipated film of the year. And from the very first scene, which, as you mentioned in your recap, the car crashing, it's very, very similar to the sort of cold open of Raw. It leads to the title card, similar to that film. And then we come out of that into this wonder of her sort of navigating this this floor of this car show and all these dancers grinding on the hoods of these automobiles. And I had seen a few images that had snuck into my Twitter feed, but I had avoided previews because I just wanted to engage the film on its own terms. But in that moment, I was just like so locked and loaded. I was just ready to go. And the movie kind of proceeds along those lines for a while, and then it just breaks in a really weird way. And even by Julia Ducournau's admission, you know, she's talked about how, similar to what you were saying, Michael, this isn't necessarily a plot-driven thing. There's a whole lot more going on thematically and vibe-wise that I think she's just kind of interested in chasing these impulses. So I wasn't really sure after coming out of the movie how best to describe my feelings about it, because it went to such strange places and was extremely interested in just doing its own thing. But Amanda, I know you saw it a couple nights, or you saw it a couple times in the course of like 2 or 3 days. I think I was in a similar boat. I think 2 or 3 days later, I went into a theater to see it again. And I really, really enjoyed it more the second time. I don't think it's ever going to reach the heights of Raw for me. I just love that film so unreservedly. This one is just a little bit tougher to pin down. But I love that she was enabled and empowered to make exactly what movie she wanted to make. This seems like such a pure and clear artistic expression, and I could not be more excited to see what she does after this. So those are my thoughts.
Awesome. Amanda, as Raymond just said, you are also part of the Two Time to Tong Club.
Okay.
What are your first impressions?
I saw it a second time because I had to write a video about it for Wisecrack. Check it out. Coming out in like a week or something.
Yeah, soonish. But by the time you get this podcast, it should be out within less than a week.
Yeah, we'll cover it on the next episode or two of Talking to Ten as well.
That would be so meta to do commentary on my
video. We'll have to have you back.
The funniest thing was the second time I saw it, it was at like a 10:30 a.m. showing, and I was one of two people in the theater, and I just really wanted to like talk to that guy and just be like, what's going on for you? the usher even warned me. She was like, are you ready for this at 10:30? I was like, yes. And I felt like such a cinephile. No. Anyway, this movie, it's totally bonkers. I am racking my brains trying to think of a movie as strange as this. Like, not even like Holy Motors, I feel like, could like compare. It's just, it's so its own thing. I mean, I read one of her interviews. She's like, I completely broke the three-act structure. And like Raymond said, like she abandoned. I feel like she kept pretty faithful to it in Raw. And I feel like in this one, she just sort of was like, fuck that. I'm going to do exactly what I did with Raw. And I'm not going to follow structural convention, which I always appreciate. But it very visceral. I had to close my ears, close my eyes multiple times on both viewings. I'm squeamish. But I found like the protagonist so weird and yet compelling. And there were just like all these very strange nuances. Mm-hmm. Like every time she killed somebody, she like almost hugged them as they died. It was just, it's like, there was just a lot of dichotomies that I feel like you don't see in most, like, because, I mean, yeah, frankly put, like, the protagonist is, like, a stone-cold killer who does not appear to experience any remorse for her actions. And yet, it's, like, so much more nuanced than that. I think it definitely like wins like the most interesting film I've seen in a very long time.
Nice. That's great. I'll quickly give my first impressions as well. I do think that after all this time of waiting to see it, I think that I saw it during Raymond's second viewing. Didn't we determine we were in the same theater?
We kind of triangulated this during our previous conversation. I can't remember if it was on the podcast or not.
I don't think it was. I think it was off air. Occasionally, we do not record our conversations. I don't like when we do that. But yeah, I saw this movie because I had heard a lot about it. And you know, when it won the Palme d'Or, that's obviously a big deal. I'm also currently trying to make myself someone who can experience gnarly or spooky things. It's obviously well known for anyone who has consumed any Wisecrack content that I'm kind of anti-spookiness. So not even anti, it just hasn't been for me. So I made a decision, like, I'm going to go see this movie. So a couple Fridays ago, I'd finished up my work at Wisecrack Industries. I took public transportation down to the Alamo Draft House in downtown Los Angeles, which is probably my favorite place to see movies in the city. I got there very early. I was the first one who sat down. The lovely person working there was like, kind of the same thing. She was like, oh my God, are you ready for this? I hear blah, blah, blah about it. And I was like, okay. And I was really glad I saw it by myself because I was definitely doing a lot of like holding my hat kind of down over my eyes for a bit. And in my internal monologue was very much like, it's just a movie, Michael, look at the screen, look at the screen. And you know, you hear all these stories about people passing out in the aisles or blah, 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 which I think like, oh, it's probably just a bunch of French cowards. During her first kill, I got nauseous physically because of the mouth foam from the victim. That made me feel like I could throw up. As the movie went on, it becomes another film. So by the end of this movie, and there's like gnarly stuff, you know, scattered throughout, but I really did find it beautiful by the end. And I found, you know, the story to be something, and I know I said there's like not a real story, but the emotional transformation or the personal transformation of the characters I loved. And I'm definitely someone who in general, one of my favorite genres of film is like the found family story, whether it's in TV or film. I'm always very compelled by that, probably because I do not like my biological family, but I like a lot of, I guess, my immediate family. I love my extended biological family. But you know, I think that is an important thing, and I like to see that explored. And you know, I'd rather watch a bad character break good than a good character break bad, which I think is kind of what happens to an extent in the film. But like Amanda said, it was an experience. Like the credits rolled, and whoever was sitting right behind me in the theater, kind of like under their breath but kind of loud, just said, "What the fuck?" And that really spoke to me. I was like, "Yes, I'm feeling the same thing." And that evening, I thought I didn't like it at first, or I thought it was just okay. I read some reviews immediately, went and got beers with a friend, went to bed thinking I didn't like it, woke up the next morning, and it was the first thing I was thinking about. Couldn't stop thinking about this movie. And I liked it the more time I had to sit with it, such that I even went and I updated my gut reaction Letterboxd score because I wanted to be, you know, consistent with the journey. But really great film. I still have not gone back to watch Raw. I'm going to do it soon on a sunny day. It's on Netflix right now. So I just want to make sure I can watch it and then immediately go like go on a hike and listen to Mac DeMarco or something just to really, you know, have some very non-cannibalistic vibes. But yeah, a really, really good film. And one of those things where as someone who hates spooky stuff or gnarly stuff, and horror, I still found it really, really interesting and important. Now, before we break down all the nuance and things in this movie, just wanted to remind everyone, follow Show Me the Meaning Pod on Twitter. It's SMTM_pod, where there's deeper dives into discussions. I think Raymond's been posting a lot of really good stuff. I'm assuming that's you. I think it is. We do a lot of shadow account stuff at Wisecrack.
On the SMTM Pod account?
Yeah.
I'm afraid that is not me. No one knows who it is.
Okay, whoever is posting
it's just
is
some
doing
rogue fan. Who
a great job. Obviously, everyone already follows at TetonPod42069. So you know, you can find us there. But also follow SMTM_pod. We're posting fun facts about the films, the directors. And obviously, this is weird for me to acknowledge, but there is a brewing Twitter fight with the other Wisecrack podcast, Culture Binge, which I've heard of. I don't know which side of the fight I'm on, but if you want to participate in the fight, get involved. And also, if you listen on Apple Podcasts and enjoy these discussions, we would really, 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 really appreciate it if you drop a rating or review. It helps us grow the pod. And, you know, it's not like by growing the podcast, we're getting like raises or something. It just means we can keep doing it. We can bring on more guests. We can add some more fun stuff. And of course, if you are not a Wisecrack patron, look into it. Patreon.com/Wisecrack. We are now offering Patreon bonuses for all of our podcasts. So if you want to hear more about the movies we're talking about on this side, if you want to hear more from some of our cool guest on Culture Binge. Recently, Raymond and I had a great discussion on Culture Binge with Allison Herman, who's one of the head TV writers over at The Ringer. We had an extra discussion with her that's on Patreon as well. So check all of that out.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Okay, so let's just get into the discussion. I have a few points I want to make sure we hit, but I'm just going to start with this. And I'm not saying this to be frivolous because I think it's a fun point, because it's obviously one of the things that if people know one thing about this movie, they know that the protagonist fucks a car. And I knew that it was happening. I didn't know that's what was happening when it happens in the film. So just as a reminder for anyone who saw it and blacked out, Alexia is taking a post-murder shower, because when you murder, you want to shower afterwards. And we hear this banging on the wall. And I think if you don't know what's coming, you might think like, oh, it's the police who know that she has killed someone. But instead, she opens the door. We see what I would describe as like a pimped out Cadillac or something.
It was like a weirdly sexy car. It was like unexpected guy at the bar car.
It was a hot car, folks.
It is. It's like if anyone watched, was it Pimp My Ride with Exhibit in the early 2000s on MTV? Yeah. It's the sort of car Exhibit would have been very proud of. But the car is pounding on the door, and it shines its lights at her, and it almost indicates, like, the vibe I got was, hey, you were dancing all over me earlier. Now daddy needs to get his. Was kind of the vibe I got.
What I really liked was how consensual it was with the car.
Mm-hmm.
Love the enthusiastic consent.
Yeah, so she gets in the back of this car, she straps into the seatbelts, and they have sex. I want to hear what y'all thought kind of about that scene, and then what is going on there? Why is this the thing everyone's talking about? What are they trying to say right there? I just think it's a good entryway into the film.
I feel like we had a conversation about this, and like the first thing was, I was like, it's so weird that she fucks a car. And Burns, you were like, I feel like that was the least interesting thing about the film. And as soon as you said that, it was like weirdly enlightening. Not weirdly enlightening. You're always enlightening, but it was like always. Particularly, I mean, like sometimes, but it was like particularly, I was like, oh my God. Yeah. Like that, I almost feel like if the French director, whose name I will never be able to pronounce right, it's like she like incepted her film into like the overall consciousness through that one vehicle of like the one kind of salacious element, and then like immediately left it behind. And it was like, you were so right. It's so not the point of the film. Like it's fun. It makes for a good headline on like IndieWire, but it's like not the point. Like this is not a sexy film, you know? So I feel like you were completely right when you were like focusing on that aspect misses the real point of the film.
What do you think, Raymond?
I think that's an interesting perspective, but I would actually argue that there's much more to it than just this kind of like chaos moment that sort of kicks things off. You know, I read this as sort of an environmental allegory, and a lot of the early stuff for me is just like sort of bathing in this notion of like how we fetishize automobiles and how we blend sexuality with them already, or we project notions of masculinity onto cars and things like that. And just the idea that like taking that to its most logical extreme. There are episodes of, like, what's that TLC show, My Strange Addiction, where people are getting quite handsy with their cars. It's that was sort of in my mind watching it. And also, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, Michael, since you haven't seen Raw, but Julia DeCarnau has a tendency to use, like, the same character names throughout her work.
Uh-huh. I've heard this, yeah.
To sort of establish thematic through lines between her movies. And for example, Garance Marillier, who is the star of Raw, her name is Justine in that film. Her name is Justine in this film. She did a short film with Julia DeCarnau in which she plays a younger version of Justine who goes through puberty in the course of that short. And that character always has this sort of, not necessarily naive, but she has a blinkered approach to life where she's always learning as she goes. And a lot of the time her character is a victim to, like, the whims of nature, whether it's puberty or emerging womanhood in Junior and Raw respectively, or in this weird force of nature that is Alexia, who shares a name with Ella Rumpf's character in Raw, who, similar to this movie, is just, like, almost a pure expression of id. She's, like, so hedonistic, and she's just, like, when her sister catches up with her in Raw, the discoveries that she makes about her as her older sister, as someone that she used to, like, look up to and not necessarily idolize, but at least emulate, the way that she has changed and the way that she has embraced it becomes very, very scary to Justine. And I like kind of reading it as a similar outgrowth of those type of character dynamics, that Alexia is, it's not just that she fucks a car, it's that she represents this hedonistic synthesis between man and machine. And that, you know, in my personal estimation, she is sort of like, not necessarily the midwife of the apocalypse, but as the director says, she's bringing, like, a new mutant or mutated or more harsh sort of life form into Earth that is better equipped for the world that we've created.
Yeah, I want to jump on something you said, but, just while we're still there.
Sorry for monologuing.
No, it's fully good. That's what we do on the Tatancast. But you mentioned Alexia being the synthesis, right, of human and machine. And I think, in a sense, early in the film, I kind of viewed it as this dialectical opposition between flesh and mm-hmm. sort of dead matter. And I think by the end of the film, the scene that really stood out to me was after the car accident and the surgery, you know, Alexia doesn't embrace mom or dad. She embraces the very car that mm-hmm. she cracked her head open in. And I think then when we flash forward, it's kind of like you think about the way in which she treats the humans that she kills early on. And I think, too, there's something interesting where the first kill, it's like, okay, this guy was, like, kind of being harassy, whatever, fuck it. But then some later kills, it's like, oh, they didn't do anything. You're just killing to kill now. But I think, you know, Amanda made this point that she kind of holds them for a second, almost in this way that's like, ah, you poor bastard. But it does remind me of the way in which, you know, if I have a toaster and the toaster breaks, I throw it in the trash and I don't think about it again because it's dead material. And to me, there almost seemed like this opposition where the Alexia character identified more with the toaster than with the human being early on. And that it's, I feel like throughout the film, you know, we do have this transition from matter to human. And then obviously I think that the car baby might represent something of a new humanity, a synthesis between those things. But I don't know. I guess when I looked at the car thing early on, it was just sort of like, well, of course she can make love to the car because for her, just material is where it's at, not flesh.
Sure.
Yeah. No, I think that's all super valid. And obviously the whole metal plate in her head connects her to the immaterial. Totally. But I feel like, and even just, like, mathematically, so little of the film was spent with, like, that aspect of her. So much of the film was spent with, like, the consequences
yeah.
of behaving the way that she did. And so I feel like the salacious coverage is all about the first like 40 minutes. And to me, what's like super interesting is like, and we talk about this some in the video that's coming out, like by the time you hear this, yay. But like the idea of like, I mean, like Burns was talking about like found family, chosen family, like the idea that like, I mean, also like there's obviously a lot of body horror, but I feel like usually body horror is like to symbolize like that a character is actually horrific. Whereas in this film, it's weirdly like the body horror of like her swelling body, her like the motor fluid coming out of her body, the Vincent's like steroid injections, like the more grotesque they become, the more human they become, and the more like human they're able to find each other. And that's just so backwards from what body horror usually is. And that to me is like what's super fascinating about the film.
Sure. There is this sort of like, I don't necessarily want to say organic, but there's a willing fusion with the material that like, mm-hmm. even with regards to the people whom she kills. And there is a slight implication. I'm curious, Amanda, what your thoughts were on this on a second viewing. I don't know if you caught it on a first viewing, Michael, but when the TV is on in the background of an early scene, they talk about some other serial killings that have happened in the area. So I don't, there's,
That's how I read that. I read that as like
that was her.
She'd been about that life.
Yeah, I had kind of assumed.
Been doing it a while, and the dad knew. The dad looked at her. Like there was a very clear shot where the dad looks at her. He knows she's a serial killer. Also, am I crazy, or did she literally set her house on fire?
She burned her parents' house.
Mm-hmm. And we just never deal with it again. And I also was thinking, and then it's like so fascinating that she then goes to a firefighter.
Well, yeah, that's part of, I think, the environmental message with it as well, that like not only is this something about a woman who kind of embodies this force of nature, it's this guy who is, you know, quite literally fighting against time with his aging body. Trying to undo that sort of damage, the damage that, you know, it's like natural environmental destruction, but it's symbolized by the fire that she starts with her parents in it. And not only that, but what I was going to say is just the sort of like willing fusion of man with machine that throughout the film, she kills with metal, or she's with Justine, she's trying to tear the metal nipple rings out of her. Mm-hmm. And there's this notion that I get, like on a second viewing at least, that one of the things that humanizes her father figure, I can't remember his name, but Vincent Landon's character.
That's his one name of the movies, Vincent as well.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what threw me for a loop. But one of the things that I think kind of helps her extend a sort of empathy or grace towards him is that he's already doing that. He's putting the needles in his body already. Like she, you know, the way that she is kind of like revisiting her trauma on all these people in a way makes me feel like she's trying to find others like her that are like similarly hardened for the future. And ultimately she's the one who has to bring that thing to bear. But
it's an interesting parallel though with Vincent, like by putting steroids in his body. I think we like think of steroids as this artificial thing, but in a sense it's trying to perpetuate life. Like what does a steroid do other than try to increase the production of, you know, certain cells and proteins within the body?
Or at least perpetuate youth and vigor.
Yeah. Exactly. Like he's clinging. Like she even asks him at one point, like, why do you do, like, do you do this because you're weak or something? And he's like, no, I do it because I'm old. Like, he's very much about, like, youth. Sorry, you were saying something, Burns.
Well, no, I just think, like, in talking about Vincent, there's that. And I do think, for me, a pivotal point of the film is when Alexia's first with Vincent, this is, like, day one or two, and she, like, they have their little like dance that turns into a fight. And then she does the thing where she pulls, you know, her steel hairpin out, the thing that she's used to kill the others. And he just looks at her like, oh, really, you asshole? This is what you got? And just smacks it out of her hand with zero effort and kind of like laughs at her. And it's so interesting that the first 15 minutes of this film, this person is using that tool to terrorize individuals, yeah, to have whatever sort of body count. And into Vincent, it's like, oh, he's like, you think, yeah, this is scary for me?
I stick
like,
that in my glute every day. Yeah.
The thing that really, like, I still am not getting about the film is, like, when the way she kills that, the young woman, Justine.
Yeah.
Like, that, it's still not, like, clicking for me. Is it that she's, like, Yeah, I don't know. I'm curious if you guys have thoughts on it.
The only thing I thought there was, because there's the moment where she's messing around with Justine, and then she does the, which low-key was also very hard to watch, the, like, just aggressive biting of the nipple ring. Yeah, as someone that has 19 rings in each of my nipples, that just really affected me. Kind of like Andrew Cuomo type over here. That was the thing, right, where Andrew Cuomo had, like, nipple rings?
Yeah, that's a theory.
Very strange nipples. There are multiple New York Magazine articles about them, and they are all a trip.
Oh, and also, do look up Cuomo Cast on iTunes, Spotify, whatever. We're starting a new podcast on Cuomo, so we'll be talking about that as well. But no, because there's right where Justine kind of says dismissively, first time with a girl or something like that. And it felt a little bit like that was, there was that that happened. And then they run back into the house and it's the first time that oil comes out of her vagina. And it felt like those two things led to, I don't know, like it almost felt like a moment of vulnerability on Alexia, the mixed vulnerability of, you know, if anyone was ever being intimate or you're fooling around with someone and they like make fun of you or laugh at you, it feels like shit. And then combined with feeling out of control of her body when the oil starts leaking, it felt to me like it created a moment of vulnerability that led to that kill. Or am I overthinking it and she's just out here killing?
I think it's tempting to project that sort of like emotional read onto someone who I think kind of by design is supposed to be sort of a blank slate early on. You know, I generally think that she's kind of just compelled to kill in a way. But I also think there are aspects of her relationship with Justine, like I was referring before. I think she recognizes in Justine a little, like, she also has some metal in her, whether, you know, it may be cosmetic, whereas Alexia's is, you know, medical, but there is sort of a kindred relationship there, and when she recognizes that is just cosmetic or just surface level, maybe it feels like a betrayal to her in some way. But like I said, that it's very easy to project a lot of stuff when I think intentionally the artists are giving you so little in those moments.
Right, like Anton Chigurh. I can never say his last name.
No, you said it right.
I think you got it.
Oh, yeah. I did. Sure. Okay, great.
Anton, like, if you're listening, we're big fans. No disrespect.
I apologize. Please leave the cattle prod at home when you come angrily to my door. Like how much are we supposed to think that she has normal human emotions at that point in the film?
Not a lot, right?
Probably not.
I think if she is like the progenitor of the next step in human evolution, at least as presented by this film, it is one of those things where it's like she doesn't necessarily connect with these folks because she has transcended this sort of not necessarily this earthly coil, but she's transcended this humanity, and it's not until she finds people who are on a similar wavelength that that she's able to soften a little bit.
Well, let me ask you guys this. Where do you think the point of the film is, or how does it happen? Where do you see Alexia's and Vincent's journeys coming together? What is the inflection point in which we do start to see a change in both of those characters?
I mean, well, I think like one thing we haven't talked about is like just gender in the film and how Alexia really only becomes a person when she starts pretending to be a boy, and how the moments where Vincent seems most human are when he's letting go of his need for like classic masculine attributes like power. You know, at one point he tells the other firemen, he's like, I'm God, so Alexia is Jesus. And you're like, that's not really a way to make friends. So, so I feel, and the steroids, obviously, classic masculinity, clinging to his virulent youth kind of a thing.
But so also clinging to his past and his love for his son, and not wanting to let that aspect of his life go. Sorry for cutting you off.
No, but I guess all I'm saying is that I feel like beyond like the machine level, I think she's also saying that like boxing yourself into like classic femininity or masculinity is like dehumanizing.
Sure.
And makes it impossible to relate to other people in like a full, meaningful way.
Yeah. And I do like that point you made, Amanda, where like queerness becomes this middle ground for both of them, where Alexia starts to find herself as she's performing as the sun, and then Vincent seems to find himself or express himself when he's like, you know, dancing to Future Islands with his firemen buddies.
Or like cradling the baby at the end.
Of course, yeah.
Like a mom, and yeah.
I also think it's important to note that like there's a similar kind of symbolism happening in Raw with the Adrian character in that as well, played by, I'm sure I'll mispronounce this, but Rabah Naïd Ufala. Adrian in that, which is the name that she takes on when she's impersonating the fireman's son, is mm-hmm. similarly kind of like a deliberate... He's a gay man, but he doesn't really prescribe to any one sort of stereotype or cliche, and even so much as late in the film has a bit of a romantic tryst with his female roommate Justine, and there is a weird way that like that character she's always playing with that name of she's always playing with these character dynamics of people who aren't easily boxed in by societal expectations or, as you were saying, Amanda, gender norms.
Yeah, and any of the interviews with Ducournau as well, she seems to get at that, like that things like love and gender are these boxed in categories that she's not interested in. Like she's not interested in the framing of those things, but interested in humanity itself and love itself. And thinking of those things in more dynamic terms.
And she also said that she auditioned male, female, and non-binary actors for Alexia / Adrian, that she was really not concerned at all with the gender construct when she was casting this, so much as how that character would be presented at certain times throughout the story. But Amanda, what were you going to say?
Oh, in a different interview I read, she kind of talked about the scene where Adrian dances for the fireman. She describes it as like a queer paradise or something. And that was really interesting to me because it was so, like, she was dancing in many of the same ways that, like, she was dancing at the beginning of the film, like, for ogling heterosexual men. Mm-hmm. But it just read so differently when it was, like, her choice. And it was very, I may have lost the thread. But you know what I mean? It was just,
no, I know what you're saying.
It was saying that, like, I feel like, it was very much saying that, like, there's nothing wrong with, like, performing mm-hmm. hypersexuality as long as, like, you're in ownership of it and choosing to do it.
And it also says a lot about the other firefighters as well, because that's the exact type of thing, or they may be the exact type of person that in the scene from earlier in the film when she's performing on the hood of the car, they might be the guys who are totally into that, but because of their own notions or expectations of gender or the people with whom they surround themselves in that moment, it's just this really wicked play on their own sexuality where the movie makes a point of showing these guys as having these sort of homosocialized relationships mm-hmm. where they don't have any compunction or shame about like dancing with each other and just like going crazy and getting shirtless and partying down. And then as soon as someone gets up on top of a fire truck and makes it more overtly sexualized or explicitly sexualized, mm-hmm. that's where like all of their, you know, their guard just sort of falls, or rather maybe they start putting it back up. They have to start reassuming that masculine shell in a way.
I mean, that's classic like unconscious homoeroticism amongst masculine presenting dudes. The second it's called out and it's no longer just an unconscious thing, everyone scatters. As we got to sort of, you know, eventually get the car towards the garage, to be clear, I'm in the back of the car naked in this scenario.
Wouldn't have it any other way, Mike.
Yeah, of course. But before we wrap, I do want to talk about this. So at the end of the film, mm-hmm. we have a birth, and we love birth scenes. We love babies. We love life. This one's a little different, and it's a very intense last scene where Alexia and Vincent seem to admit like they do love each other. And Alexia seems so confused by what it means to love that at one point she starts, you know, kissing Vincent. And I think when I was in the theater, I was like, oh no, if she fucks her kind of dad, I gotta be out of this. But it wasn't. To me, it seemed like this overwhelming sense of like, how do I love? How do I express this? I don't know what it's like. Mm-hmm. We go right into the birth from there. You know, huge spoiler alert here. For some reason, you've gotten this far in. I'm gonna give you
20 episodes. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, a baby comes out of her. She dies. Vincent hugs the baby. The baby has a car spine, but it looks like it's babyish. But we see like a metal spine. There's oil
and also a plate in it.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
So what do we make about that? What were our reads on? Maybe our reads on the end of the film, or just, you know, what we were left with. Because the film does end on that note.
I feel like the moment of like kind of recognition between them when she finally says her real name, was very beautiful. I feel like the fact that she tried to kiss him first speaks to like what we've kind of talked about, we talk about a lot in the video, which is like the idea of classic relationship paradigms of mother, father, daughter, son, blah blah blah, like romantic partner, friend, blah, like they're not that relevant to the director. She's like very just much about like love and connection, and I feel like that was the confusion that that Alexia like kind of demonstrated when she tried to kiss him. With the birth of the son, I mean, I don't know. I think I feel like it was maybe coded as a boy. Who cares? Whatever. The birth of the baby, with like the car spine. It's definitely the thing that's been most confusing to me about the film. And I think it, like, to me, it's an extension of like the grotesqueness and yet lovability of like the human body. That this baby can be so visibly grotesque and Vincent can instantly accept him and love him. But yeah, I'm curious because I feel like Raymond has a whole other allegory going on that I had not thought about at all.
Yeah, do it, Raymond.
Well, I had alluded to this before, but I read it largely, not exclusively, but largely as an environmental allegory. And seeing the baby delivered at the end that has been transformed or mutated. I think even Julia Ducournau said in an interview that she thinks the child is more suited to the coming world, specifically because of its monstrousness. And in a way that makes it sort of a hopeful ending that, you know, there is a way for us to adapt and live on, whether it is in the face of you know, environmental crises or in the face of individual injustice, because we can't ignore, Amanda, like you said, the baby to you was maybe coded male, but I don't think it really matters. You know, it's one of those things where so much of the film is about embracing androgyny, and it's really like one of the only times that Alexia really uses her male disguise is to not only hide in plain sight, but when she's on the bus and there's a woman being harassed by a group of men, she is able to hide in plain sight there because she's coded as a man. And I kind of like this notion, this optimism of a new sort of generation of folks who aren't defined by any one demographic or personal characteristic, and who are ready to like fuse together and try and make the world maybe a better place, or at least somewhere that's a little bit more inhabitable or hospitable to others. That was the long and the short of it for me. Michael, what do you think?
Well, just, I know Amanda has something to say, so I'll just really quickly say the one thing it did make me think of is there is a kind of movement in recent, and by recently last 20 years, of like continental philosophy and theory stuff, of this notion of kind of like the post-human, and how we think about humanity in terms of like a symbiosis with various technological things. So some people will say, you know, we are already post-human because part of my consciousness is connected to the tiny device in my pocket that mediates knowledge, communication, information, all this other stuff. But then, of course, whether it's our ability to create prosthetic limbs or our ability to, you know, literally use technology to shape the brain or how someone sees or hears, whatever it might be, there is a sense that the future of humanity is one in which a type of inorganic life is going to join with organic life, and that we need to redefine or rethink our categories of traditional humanity and what that means socially, politically, sexually, all those sorts of things. So, you know, there was the grad school brain started to light off a little bit at the end right there, because I think that is the fantasy of a certain type of theorist. And not to you know, shove that into the text, but on a side related note, I was really psyched when I found out that De Cournot studied philosophy at the Sorbonne for college. Thought that was very cool. Studied film and philosophy there. And, you know, for those that don't know, that's it's a very good university. If you're in France to study philosophy at the Sorbonne means you are passing a very intensive entrance exam, and you are studying with some very big shit philosophers. So thought that was also a cool fact to know that this filmmaker is someone who did study philosophy, and a lot of the interviews referenced existentialism and other sort of European philosophical movements as if it was second nature to her. So, but yeah, Amanda, you were about to say something great. I interrupted it.
Oh my gosh, no, I don't think I was. I think, yeah, I think I lost the thread. Don't even worry.
Okay, well, we should get wrapping up.
That was really interesting anyway.
Yeah. So how about any final thoughts on this one before we wrap up? Anything that is overwhelming? And once again, we got renewed by Jeff Bezos to do 100 more episodes of this podcast. So we don't have to get it all out now. But if there's anything that you feel like you haven't gotten to say about Titan that you want to say now.
What do you got, Amanda?
Corny. I just feel like it's
the movie's
very
corny.
No, I just feel
I think
like
she is.
I think what I'm saying is corny. It's very invigorating to like see people like this director like creating like female protagonists that I haven't seen before. Sure. With like more nuance than I've ever seen before, and like I don't know, like it's easy, I think, like as like a like it can be easy to get like discouraged about the film industry and like moments like this at 10:30 when I'm watching someone get stabbed in the ear with a hairpin and film at the mouth. I'm like, wow, there's still new shit to be made.
Yeah. I was going to say something kind of in the same ballpark as that, which is that, you know, we've been talking to Tan so much for the past 20 weeks. I really just want to give it up to Julie De Cournot. I think she's a great filmmaker. She's clearly a great creative mind. I mentioned before, I'm so excited to see what she does next. But also, she really appreciates the lineage in which her films are being situated. You know, she's an acolyte of David Cronenberg. And just for a spooky October rec, everyone, if you haven't seen David Cronenberg's Crash, it's a phenomenal double feature with this movie. There's some clear influences, not only from that, but across his filmmaking spectrum. And I definitely recommend it.
Okay.
The Fly in our video.
Actually. Love The Fly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Another great body horror. Yeah. I'm getting a light from our producer in the booth that we do have to wrap things up, because I guess Kelly Rowland from Destiny's Child is coming to the studio next to record her podcast on the early work of Wes Anderson. Yeah, you are a guest on that. They're talking Bottle Rocket today. Real quick then, don't even think about this. What's the hottest car, Raymond? Car that you find the hottest?
The hottest car?
If you had to think a car was sexy, beautiful, hot.
Hey, the Model T.
He likes some classic, sturdy. That's great, Amanda. What's just the sexiest
experience
car you can think of?
I'm really wholesome. I really like a Bug Beetle.
Oh, I love it. Bug Beetle, kind of free flowing hippie vibes, whatever. I'm gonna say, and there's a lot of
VW bus for Michael the Deadhead.
I want to say the GW bus, but I'm gonna VWS. I'm gonna go Jeep Wrangler, and this is really weird, but I think it's because of Lorelai Gilmore. because I think of Lorelai in a Wrangler, and she's great. I don't know, a Jeep Wrangler to me, fun, outdoorsy. We're in nature. No one's around. There's no judgment. We can do what we want.
Quick piece dialogue.
Like, yeah, let's wrap it up. You know, my parents are coming in and making it weird at the end and judging me. My daughter's awkwardly involved in a way she shouldn't be. But and as everyone knows, once again, on a normal Show Me the Meaning, we would have a mailbag. But on the Tomcasters,
Show Me the Meaning?
It's another it's an adjacent podcast in the same family. No mailbag right now. Show Me the Meaning, which is a podcast. Follow the Twitter account. We'll be back next week with an episode on Squid Game, which isn't a movie. Yeah. It's a series on Netflix. And here's just a fun thing for everyone out there. Wisecrack is putting out videos on Titan and Squid Game in the coming week. So please check both of those out. Let us know what you think. For Squid Game, we will be live streaming it at the normal time, 6 p.m. PST on the Wisecrack YouTube channel. Before we go, Amanda, where can people find you on the social media?
Oh my God, I'm so bad at social media.
Watch you don't have to say this if you don't want.
Yeah, I mean, no, I have a Twitter. I'm just Amanda Shirker, boring. And then watch our videos. I write and edit them, and it turns my hair gray. So you might as well enjoy them.
Yes, as everyone can see on video, just so much gray hair. Raymond, how about you? Where can folks find you?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter and Letterboxd. I'm at Crematoria, and you can find Raw on Netflix. Watch it.
Awesome. Michael O'Burns on Twitter, and I think on Letterboxd, I'm at Breezy42069. Okay. I think that's what I am on there. So make what you will of that. But I'll let Raymond do our traditional sign-off that you've all come to know and love after 20 episodes. So thanks for sticking around. Raymond, she's all yours.
And as always, folks, we've reached Titan.
Okay, good times. Great oldies, everyone.